And we've got a pretty good show for you. We have in the audience today, we have a guest, Sue.
Yes.
All right. Can you speak right in that microphone?
Sure.
Okay. We'll try to get those levels adjusted correctly here and make sure it comes through. But we're going to be talking a little bit about some recent events, some recent good news about wolves and some other things. But first, I'd like to make a few quick, very quick announcements. On this Saturday, the Palouse Group Sierra Club and Friends of the Clearwater are hosting a hike. It's going to be one of those all-day wild hikes up to the Buffalo Hump. I meet at Rose Hours at the wee hour of 6 a.m. and in the Gospel Hump Wilderness up to the Buffalo Hump. So it'll be quite a day. If you want more information, 882-9755. If you want to show up and carpool with folks, meet at Rose Hours at 6. Of course, bring some warm clothes. This will be a strenuous hike, and ought to be a good time. On October 10th of next week, there will be a presentation by Nicolas Barbier, who is he's 29 years old. He's a PhD student enrolled at the University of Bourgogne in the geography department and at University of Idaho as a visiting scholar. He's lived most of his life in the Picardy region north of Paris, and he also worked for a couple of years in Paris where he worked as a cartographer. And he's doing some work with Gunders Rudzidis here at the University of Idaho. So anyway, this will be a good presentation. It's being sponsored by several organizations, and it's going to be held at, in I believe, the Law Room 105. It's not the Law Auditorium, but the room as you come in to the Law Building. It's the one on the left. And he's going to present a first version of a documentary film he's making, focusing on land and jurisdictional conflicts in the 1863 Nez Perce Reservation. Several Nez Perce people speak about this. It's a very important film. The documentary film is going to cover the land issue of the Nez Perce, the wolf and salmon issues as well. So, wolf reintroduction. He's those parts are being completed for his actually PhD dissertation. He's doing a documentary film. So that's going to be at 7 o'clock in room, I think 105 of the Law Building, the Law School Building in the University of Idaho campus. Be a very interesting presentation. And a couple of other announcements. Judge Redden ruled that the region can't afford the failed salmon plan, so it's back to the drawing board for the plan that wasn't too good. The conservation groups that challenged this plan, Save Our Salmon, and the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen were pretty excited about this decision, although some of Idaho's politicians did not like it. Again, I'm not sure they want to see salmon recover. Another interesting piece of good news last week. The judge banned snowmobiles to protect caribou in North Idaho in 500 acres in the Selkirk Mountains. So that was a good ruling by District Judge Robert Whaley and the Selkirk Conservation Alliance. A good group up in Priest River, Idaho, is to be thanked for that victory on that decision. And one more announcement, and we'll talk a little bit about this later in the program as well. But Earth Justice just won a lawsuit victory in Montana on listing of wolverines as an endangered species. Fish and Wildlife Service has to go back and look at that. One of the plaintiff organizations on that lawsuit was Friends of the Clearwater locally, who provided a lot of information about the wolverine. And for the lawsuit, and the Fish and Wildlife Service now has to conduct a study to determine if wolverines should be listed in the Endangered Species Act. Some of the other plaintiffs besides Friends of the Clearwater on that were Defenders of Wildlife, National Group Conservation Northwest out of the Cascades there in the Bellingham, Seattle area, and the Klamath Siskiyou Wilderness Alliance, a group down in southwest Oregon and probably that northern part of California. Idaho and the Wild Clearwater Country is actually blessed with perhaps the healthiest population, although there's not a lot of wolverines, the healthiest population in the lower 48. They're probably even rarer, fewer numbers probably than even grizzlies. Jeff Copeland, who is a wolverine researcher, says that there's probably hundreds in the lower 48. And a big study area, like a 100 square kilometer study area, there may only be 15 to 20 animals. They can range 100 square miles for females and up to 500 square miles for males. They don't have exclusive territories, so they do overlap with each other a little bit. And they're also doing a study up near Elk Summit on the Lolo Pass, trying to look at wolverines, lynx, and fisher. So that's another bit of good news. So, Sue, we'll be going into the wolves here right when we get back after these announcements. I thought, though, to kick it off, we've got a couple songs queued up here. We've got Walking Jim Stoltz, and maybe the Eye of the Hunter might be a good song to sort of kick us off with. So we'll start with that song right now.
Fisher lopes through a silent forest. Sense is primed and something's gonna die. There's a rumbling in a valley and somewhere there is life. To feed the hunger in the hunter's eyes. Cry of the wolf brings life to the herd. Elk-like rivers pouring through the night. Oh, the teeth that feed will keep them strong. In the gleam of a hunter's sight. It's a howl of life, it's a growl of spirit, it's a flash of some sun-bleached bone. It's a call of the wild, it's a eye of the hunter, burning with a fire all its own. Track of the cat cross a white drifted snow. Be all that's left of her kind. There's a story written in the stain of blood that the lynx has left behind. It's a howl of life, it's a growl of spirit, it's a flash of some sun-bleached bone. It's a call of the wild, it's a eye of the hunter, burning with a fire all its own. High in the mountains, the storms blow cold. Takes a tough one to face that winter scream. But there's one that dens in the home of the winds. She's a fierce one, that bold wolverine. badger's persistence and the swift fox speed and the strength of that big grizzly bear and the marten's beauty and the wit of the coyote. Behold the spirit of the hunter there. It's a howl of life, it's a growl of spirit, it's a flash of some sunbeach pole. It's a call of the wild, it's a eye of the hunter, burning with a fire all its own. It's a howl of life, it's a growl of spirit, it's a flash of some sunbeach pole. It's a call of the wild, it's a eye of the hunter, burning with a fire all its own. Burning with a fire all its own. Burning with a fire all its own.
And that was Walking Jim Stoltz with Eye of the Hunter, an appropriate song for today. We are back listening to KRFP Moscow, Idaho. This is a Wild Clearwater Country Show. This is Gary here at the microphone. I have Sue Westervelt with me, a special guest. We're going to talk a little bit about another critter with teeth. We mentioned the wolverine in the lawsuit. But when we're talking about that, the big spooky one that some people think, is a very frightening animal, but thus far we haven't had any confirmed attacks in at least the United States in a long time from wolves. And I think they had one in Canada, which probably is better to term that a dog because it's been habituated to humans and it's kind of living there and around the dump and people would feed it and all sorts of things. And I think that wolf did attack and maybe even killed someone or hurt someone up in Saskatchewan somewhere recently. But it's interesting. Wolves are probably less dangerous than cars, bees, dogs, which, of course, they're genetically very close. In fact, about the same thing. Before we get into the program today, Sue's got some breeding she wants to talk to us about. Let's talk a little bit, Sue, about a very recent decision. Decisions, actually. We've got the Idaho Fish and Game has sort of withdrawn their proposal because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said they needed more information and that it really wasn't going to pass muster to kill up to 75% of the wolves in the Clearwater Country.
Right. Now they're kind of just concentrating on delisting the wolf.
Right, from the Endangered Species Act.
Right, right. And nobody really knows what they're going to do with what they're viewing as a surplus number of wolves. But there was a headline on the 21st of September, which happened to be my birthday, that says, from predator to prey. And so speculation is that eventually there will be a hunting season on wolves like there is bears and cougars.
Oh, interesting. Again, but we're looking at a very, very social animal, so a hunting season can drastically affect their behavior.
It would totally disrupt packs. And, of course, because it would be sport hunting, they would seek out the big creatures with the beautiful fur coats mm-hmm. and things like that, you know. So it's really, at this point, I don't think that anyone really knows what kind of an impact that would have on the wolf population.
Or what it would have on behavior and where they could still behave as wolves and fill their ecological role. That's
exactly.
A good question.
Yeah. As it is, the packs have been disrupted so many times, you know, from taking out the alpha pairs and moving them around and just breaking up the packs, and they're having to reform all the time. And so it's really a questionable practice.
And so the Idaho State Fish and Game Department and the Idaho Governor's Office, I suppose, are more or less concerned about trying to get them delisted rather than going through this other process because they don't have the science behind them. They can't show that wolves indeed are the problem. So, very interesting.
Right. As it is, they're talking about, that they're going to have to go through the NEPA process, the National Environmental Protection Act, which could take up to a year. And so whatever they decide, it's not going to be the immediate future.
So what we have three states here. They want to delist by state now. That's the new news. In the Northern Rockies where wolves are starting to recover, we have Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. Idaho's state plan is terrible. It only allows for 10 to 15 packs. And it seems like anything more than that would be killed. So wolves would not play their ecological role in the state of Idaho. Montana's is a much better plan, although still insufficient. And Wyoming's plan didn't even pass muster with the Bush administration's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So it is absolutely atrocious. It's basically wolves would be shot on sight anywhere except Yellowstone National Park and a couple of the wilderness areas that surround Yellowstone, like the Washakie and North Absaroka and Teton Wildernesses, for example. Wow. And even that plan. And what the Fish and Wildlife Service promised was they wouldn't delist the wolves until they met certain criteria, that the wolves did well in all of the population areas. There's three of them. There's the Yellowstone, what they call the Greater Yellowstone, which also does include some of the wolves in Idaho. They're in I guess, southeastern Idaho. Central Idaho population, which is everything from the Sawtooths and the mountains down there, I guess the Lost Rivers, Boulder White Clouds, all the way up to basically I-90.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually goes into North Idaho. And then there's the Northwest Montana panhandle population that's everything north of I-90 in and around Glacier Park, the Selkirks in Idaho, the Cabinets and some of those mountains up there. And those wolves, interestingly, haven't met their goals yet in having 10 breeding pair. They've had trouble, again, with, of course, humans, and they're still listed as threatened. They're not this experimental, non-essential population designation. So they're still listed with full protection under the Endangered Species Act.
I'm looking at some estimated numbers here. It says that the mid-year count was 650 wolves in Idaho, 270 in Montana, and 309 in Wyoming.
Interesting, and I wonder about those 270 in Montana. Probably most of those were down around Yellowstone. Again, the numbers, they wanted to have at least 10 packs in each of those three areas before delisting. They have decided now, this administration broke their promise, and I think, I'm not sure it's going to be legal to do so. And said, well, they can delist even though the ones in that the population north of I-90 haven't met the goals. But that's what they're trying to do is delist the wolves. That's rather interesting, those population estimates. We'll see. That's easier to tell at the end of the year when they actually do some, I guess, helicopter or airplane surveys, and it's easier to see animals with a snow on the ground. But, Another bit of news, though, is that the Forest Service basically told the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, or the Fish and Game Department, I guess, reached the conclusion they did not want to go through the process of, again, doing an environmental analysis with public involvement. I'm not sure what the Fish and Game's got against public involvement. That's, we're the ones that own the public lands, and in theory, all the wildlife in Idaho are owned by the citizens. Isn't that it? The state of Idaho?
Yeah,
the citizens.
Interesting.
They don't want to listen to the public and, again, do an analysis on the impacts of landing helicopters and other potential motorized use inside the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness, which includes also a portion of the Clearwater Drainage, the headwaters of the Selway River, actually, in the Frank Church, just above Magruder Crossing there, all that country to the south and the headwaters. That's where the Selway actually begins its run to the Pacific Ocean, is right up there. They didn't want to do that. So basically they and the Forest Service agreed that they're going to drop the proposal, which is good news, to try to radio a caller and or somehow trap wolves in the wilderness. The Fish and Wildlife Service determined they did not need collars on the wolves. There's a lot known about wolf ecology in the studies in recent years, probably the last 30, 40 years. So we have a pretty good number, pretty good idea of wolf numbers in certain areas based on, you know, prey species and whatnot. So that information probably wasn't all that critical, although the Fish and Game, they really wanted it, saying now that they have some authority to manage wolves under, again, another broken promise by the U.S. Department of Interior Fish and Wildlife Service, giving the state of Idaho authority to manage wolves in part. They felt they didn't want to go through this process either and involve the public, as it would take too long, and they figure that maybe in the future they'll be able to get in. Just as a side note, the wildernesses in Idaho, something like this, unless it could be shown was necessary for protection of the area's wilderness or would improve the wildness of the area, i.e., one hypothetical example might be, say, reintroducing an animal like the wolf or the wolverine or a grizzly to a wilderness area where they need maybe a helicopter landing to put the animals there. Unless it can show that is actually absolutely essential and that the research fulfills a wilderness purpose, they can't use motorized equipment. And this is more routine wildlife management, landing down. Of course, a fishing game can fly over, but they can't land helicopters in the wilderness. And they wanted special privileges. Unfortunately, though, in some of the recent proposed legislation in Idaho, it would allow that in some of these new, and I call them pseudo-wildernesses, that might be designated under a couple of laws, the Central Idaho Economic Development Recreation Act, and also the Owyhee Initiative would allow that kind of activity to occur, and the Forest Service or the BLM couldn't say we need to do a public analysis because it would be already written in that would allow them carte blanche authority, the Fish and Game, to do that. So there we are. Sue, I think we ought to get into your part. You make a comment and get into what you've got here for us.
Yeah, I brought a couple of books. I wanted to explore a little bit how literature is used with the wolves. And so the couple of books I have, one is a new one. It's a year old. It was 2005. And it's actually more about how writers feel about the wolf in Colorado. There's a lot of interest down there. And one of the things that really sparked some excitement earlier was a wolf dead, unfortunately, but it was a couple of years ago, and it was along Interstate 70 near Idaho Springs, Colorado, about 500 miles south of Yellowstone, and it was a female, and they thought that...
Wow, that's a long ways.
Yeah, it is, and they thought that she was probably off looking for some new territory, and so that really sparked a lot of interest in Colorado and started a lot of conversation. And so the name of this book is called Comeback Wolves, and it was Western Writers Welcome the Wolf Home, edited by Gary Walkner, Gregory McNamee, and Sue Ellen Campbell, with a foreword by Congressman Mark Udall. And he had some real interesting things to say about it. This one paragraph I thought was kind of interesting. The call of a wolf used to evoke similar respect for our natural... Oh, he was talking about the call of hawks and, you know, various things that you hear in the wilderness. And he says, the call of a wolf used to evoke similar respect for our natural world. We can experience that again, and we need not fear the wolf's return. It can remind us of the West as it once was, and as we hope to see it become, a West where opportunities are endless, where the human spirit can be uplifted and rejuvenated, and where human development and habitation can coexist with nature in its wildest forms. He's a real wise man. And so this is just a series of the contributors to this volume are science writers, novelists, poets, journalists, activists, and biologists. And they have they run the whole spectrum of what emotions and thoughts and ideas are evoked by wolves in the landscape. And one of the really interesting pieces in here was by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, and she wrote Women Who Run with Wolves.
Wow.
And,
that's right. I heard that book.
Yeah. It was an interesting book. But one of the things she says, and this really, we often hear about how similar the human race is to wolves, you know, that we're family-oriented and... well, just a number of things. But anyway, she offers these 10 rules, general wolf rules for life. And I was just struck by how applicable it is to both species, to humans and wolves. 1 is eat. 2 is rest. 3 is rove in between. 4 is render loyalty. 5 is love the children. 6 is gamble in moonlight. 7 is tune your ears. 8 is attend to the bones. 9 is make love. 10 is howl often and deeply. For as the poet Charles Simic once wrote, he who cannot howl will never find his pack. And I thought that was
great.
Just,
that's great.
I thought that was very applicable.
Wow. Wow. Continue on, Sue, and we probably ought to take, if you introduce some of the next readings here,
okay.
Maybe we ought to take a break right after that before we go into it, and just take another little musical break, and it gives us time to get the next show ready to go, a news program called Between the Lines. So here we go.
Okay. So this other volume I brought is actually an older one. It's about 10 years old. And it's out among the wolves. It's called Contemporary Writings on the Wolf. And it's actually more regional for us, I think, although it was printed in Seattle by Alaska Northwest West Books, edited by John Murray. And but there are more authors in this volume, I think, that people would recognize. The writings in the Colorado volume are wonderful and very meaningful, but... there were very few authors in that volume that I recognized, where in this one, they use all kinds of, old writings as well as more contemporary. Adolf Murray's in here, and Aldo Leopold, and Sigurd Olsen, Farley Mowat, Roger Karras. And, one of the pieces that I wanted to kind of delve into a little bit is by Barry Lopez out of his volume, Wolves and Men. And then there was another, there's Rick Bass from the Montana writer, of course. And there's a piece in here by Rick McIntyre, which I thought was also really interesting. So we'll just kind of poke around in this volume a little bit.
All right. Well, we can start doing that. I think maybe we ought to just hear a little bit more Walkin' Jim Stoltz here. Maybe we can play a song about, what do you call it, the old ones. I think that's the ones we've chosen.
Yeah, I think, yes.
All right, so he'll get into some Walkin' Jim Stoltz right now.
Come walk the open mesa. Come taste of the desert sand. Come roam the canyon narrows and feel for the age of this land. I walk with the old ones, their spirits still roam through these hills. I can hear it again on the desert wind. And the songs, they echo here still. there are those roamed here before us. The old ones, they left us no name. They lived and they loved like the sunset, they died. And the spirit still roams here untamed. I walk with the old ones. The spirits still roam through these hills. I can hear it again on the desert wind. And the songs, they echo here still. Here there is magic. Listen for the songs in the air. Watch for the signs that they'll give you. And know that the old ones are there. I walk with the old ones. Their spirits still roam through these hills. I can hear it again on the desert wind. And the songs, they echo here still.
And you're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show on KRFP Moscow, Idaho. We're back. Some readings about wolves, Sue, so why don't you just get right into it?
Okay. Both of these volumes that we're kind of exploring today also have maps showing the ranges of wolves in the United States. One of them is more in depth than the other, but it's more than just stories. It's very informational. And in the back of this, of the one I'm looking at now, Out Among the Wolves, is a chronology of the wolves, which I thought was really interesting. It starts at 20,000 BC with cave drawings of wolves in southern Europe.
Wow.
And it goes, down through Europe and all that. And then, of course, through the 1800s, and which was not a good time for wolves, but it wasn't as bad as when we got into the early 1900s, which was when things got really bad for wolves. And then it goes up to 1992. And this one was interesting, too, because it says, well, 1992 was when Rick Bass published The 9 Mile Wolves, which was a pack that he had kept tabs on up there in his Montana home. And then also it says in 1992, polls indicate 2 out of 3 Montanans favor natural recovery of wolves in the state.
Wow.
Which, of course, is what I advocated in Idaho as well, because mm-hmm. I thought that they were coming back. And by reintroducing, I think it just kind of created this whole animosity toward wolves.
I think that's a good point, Sue, and maybe also it what it did was it created a policy that didn't treat wolves as fully endangered under the Endangered Species
exactly,
Act.
Exactly, right.
And a natural recovery. We probably would still be seeing a lot of wolves in Idaho right now because we knew we had them. The natural recovery just would have taken a little more time. People would have gotten a little chance to get used to them.
Well, it would have taken more time, and it would have left us with wolves that were wilder, actually, because as they are, as we were saying earlier, they've been harassed and moved and killed and packs broken up and mm-hmm. things. And because they are in a very vulnerable state, they take the easiest prey they can. Not to say that they wouldn't, but if they were, if they had come back naturally, they would be more dispersed and they would be in wilder areas and they wouldn't be, you know, killing cattle and sheep as much. And anyway, that's the theory.
All right.
So I wanted to read this piece by Barry Lopez.
Great.
And he is talking about the predator-prey relationship. And this piece was written in 1976. And so there's been, you know, some things that we know better now, but I think there's still a whole lot of mystery attached to wolves. And so this is called Wolf Kill. Predator and prey engage in a conversation of death. No one knows how wolves pick out the animal they will try to kill. Biologists suspect that acting on certain cues from the prey, the wolves spot the older, weaker members of the herd and concentrate their killing there. They also kill surplus young. This is orderly and contributes to the balance of nature. However, it's not the rule, and since the old, the weak, and the very young are the ones least capable of eluding the wolf, the suggestion is simply tautological. In recent years, at least three ideas have surfaced to suggest that what passes between wolves and their prey is more complex and less deterministic. Hans Krook, working with hyenas in Africa, documented a surplus kill phenomenon. Hyenas, under certain conditions of extreme darkness, killed more animals than they could possibly eat. Krook found the same to be true of foxes and black-headed gulls in dense fog in England. Krook believed surplus killing was the result of a short circuit. The natural sequence of events, predator attacks, prey flees, flees, F-L-E-E-S, predator pursues, was upset because the animal couldn't see each other clearly. The hyena's urge to kill wasn't shut off, and so they simply went on killing. We talked about that earlier, Gary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Yeah.
David Meach, the American authority on wolves, saw surplus killing by wolves in northern Minnesota in 1969. He speculated that unusually deep snows prevented deer from escaping, and this triggered killing by a resident pack far beyond its needs. A second piece in the puzzle was suggested 10 years ago, which would have been in 66, by William Pruitt, who discovered by accident that wolves signal their prey, caribou in this case, if they are intent on attacking. In the absence of such a signal, caribou browse at ease. Prey also signal their predators. The antelope flashes his white rump. A deer suddenly bolts. With both predators and prey signaling each other, there is the possibility of a conversation. A third phenomenon suggests how little we know about predatory behavior in general. Meach has shown that at least one wolf pack in his Minnesota study concentrates its killing in a different area of its territory each year, allowing the prey population elsewhere to recover. Other phenomena, some worn and familiar, some recently discovered, take on new meaning. Wolves, in hot pursuit of a deer bleeding from its wounds, will suddenly break off and let the animal go. Why? One caribou in a small herd may leave off fleeing and present himself to pursuing wolves in what appears to be an altruistic sacrifice. What is happening? Biologists deal easily with the physical aspects of death, but are loath to discuss it in a sociological context. This is odd, since the same biologists agree that one of the most intriguing things about the wolf is its social behavior. The behavior of the pack is comparable in its complexity, cooperation, and exchange of information to a Paleolithic hunting group. The scraps of information gathered by the biologists who have actually seen wolves kill prey indicate that their selection is neither arbitrary nor capricious. Indeed, the kill itself may represent a response to something more complex than the simple need to eat. I think wolves kill the way Paleolithic hunters killed, by paying close attention to the movement of game herds and by selecting individual animals on the basis of various cues. The killing is by mutual agreement. This exchange between predator and prey might be called the conversation of death. Wolves are the most elusive social animals in the Northern Hemisphere. They are rarely seen. Major studies of wolves in the wild are complex, expensive, and can be counted on the fingers of both hands, remembering that this was in the late 70s. All that is known about the wolf, its social organization, biology, ecology, behavior, has been learned in the past 35 years with the perfection of aerial observation techniques and the development of the radio collar as an aid in tracking. The wolf has long had a reputation as a wanton, innately evil creature, a sort of terrestrial shark. It runs down.
What a name.
It runs down large ungulates, slashing at their hams, ripping their flanks, tearing at their heads until the animal's weakened enough to be thrown to the ground. Then it may rip open the abdominal cavity and begin eating before the animal is actually dead. And this is something that hunters and people who don't like mm-hmm. wolves always will tell you. Mm-hmm. Yet where the shark is a pea-brained loner, the wolf has proved to be a sophisticated social animal with at least three systems of intra and inter-pack communication, vocal, postural, and olfactory. He or she coordinates hunts, plans ambushes, peaceably shares food, plays with his or her young, courts a mate, and joins other wolves to howl in what one scientist calls the jubilation of wolves. Following the publication of Aldo Leopold's classic Game Management and a pioneering study of wolves by the late Adolf Murray in 1944, it was accepted that the function of wolves in the scheme of things was to cull their prey, to keep it from overpopulating an area, overbrowsing it, and starving to death. But no one knew how they did it or why. Beginning in the winter of 1959, Dave Meach spent more than 400 hours over a period of 3 years in a tiny plane suspended over the 210 square miles of Isle Royale in Lake Superior looking for wolves. During that time, when the snow conditions provided a contrasting background and the lack of deciduous growth allowed for increased visibility, Meach observed encounters between wolves and their major prey species, the moose. Of the 160 moose Meach saw from the air on Isle Royale and judged to be within range of hunting wolves, 29 were ignored, 11 discovered the wolves first and eluded them, and 24 refused to run and were left alone. Of the 96 that ran, 43 got away immediately, 34 were surrounded but not harmed, 12 made successful defensive stands, and 7 were attacked. Of these 7, 6 were killed, and 1 was wounded and abandoned. Today, 17 years later, Meach is more than 10 years into a study of wolves in northern Minnesota, where the last wolf populations in America outside Alaska is concentrated. He has watched them track, chase, and kill their primary prey species, the white-tailed deer. Meach knows the physics of how wolves kill, and he knows something about why they kill, but he still does not know why one animal in a herd is killed and another goes free. Postmortem examination of prey on Isle Royale and in other studies showed that wolves did select primarily the very young, the old, and the injured and diseased. However, the observation can be reserved. It can be said that these three groups gave themselves to the wolf, or that the animals fell victim because they were ill-equipped to escape. Vulnerable prey animals apparently announce their conditions to wolves by subtleties of stance, peculiarity of gait, rank breath, or more obvious signs of visible infection. Frequently, wolves test a herd by making it run. There is logic to the biologist's cull theory. The aged, diseased, and injured announce themselves, and the wolf dispatches them. The young are cropped to control the size of the herds and perhaps to eliminate inferior or maladaptive combinations of genes at the outset. But the drive to make the facts conform to a theory of nature in the balance, of nature in the balance, is based on at least one sweeping assumption that wolves look for moose only to kill them. Testing prey might also be a deadly form of recreation. Wolves will also attack an animal and then halt the chase for an hour to take a nap. One wolf may insist on attacking a certain individual while the rest of his pack will refuse. A pack on the hunt may investigate fresh moose tracks less than 1 minute old, pick up some subtle cue there, and not pursue. It has long been held that wolves employ hunting strategies. They are reputed to lie low in the grass, switching their tails from side to side like metronomes to attract curious but swift antelope close enough to jump them. They herd buffalo onto lake ice, where the huge animals lose their footing. On occasion, wolves employ what seems to be a conscious strategy, sending one or two individuals out to herd prey into an ambush. They vary their tactics, adapting to the terrain and to the type of prey. They prefer to attack mountain sheep from above and to work a swamp in a line abreast formation. They may split up to skirt both sides of an island in a frozen lake and then precipitously flush the game driven toward the island's tip. They use man-made roads to conserve energy and facilitate ambushes. All this is strategy, but it is not necessarily killing strategy. Once again, the wolf's chase of a prey animal may last only a few seconds, go on for miles, or carry on intermittently for days. However, the pathology of death is consistent. I won't go into that part of it. I'll skip over that. The outcome of the hunt is usually settled in the first moment, the moment of eye contact between the animals. Meech writes, "The wolves and the deer remained absolutely still while staring at each other 100 feet apart for 1 to 2 minutes. Suddenly, the deer bolted, and instantly the wolves pursued. The deer cannot stand at bay and fight off wolves as a caribou or moose can. It has no choice but to run. But with large ungulates, the outcome of the stare is less predictable. Immediately after a one-minute stare, the moose may simply walk away, or the wolves may turn and run, or the wolves may charge and kill the animal in less than a minute. This hard stare is frequently used by wolves to communicate with each other and to take the measure of strangers." There's a little sideline here that says, "Other animals, such as the gorilla, use a stare to communicate also." What transpires in those moments of staring between predator and prey is probably a complex exchange of information regarding the appropriateness of a chase and a kill. This encounter is the conversation of death. The conversation falters noticeably when wolves encounter domestic stock, animals that have had the language of death bred out of them. The domestic horse, a large animal as capable as a moose of cracking a wolf's ribs or splitting its head open with a kick, will almost always panic and run. Very frequently, it will be killed. When a wolf wanders into a flock of sheep and sees them running into each other, flipping over on their backs like turtles and panicking, there is chaos. The wolf who has initiated a prescribed ritual has received nothing in return. He has met with ignorance in an animal with no countervailing ritual of its own. So he wounds and kills to excess. When a wolf asks for an animal's life, he is opening a formal conversation that can take any number of turns, including no and yes, and can proceed either ritually or personally from there. It does not exclude play that can be lethal to the uninitiated, and it may encompass humor, although the encounter itself is not humorous. It may be compared to encounters between the war parties of Plains Indians who had their own ritualized and idiosyncratic ways of fighting, dying, and laughing. Paleolithic cultures in general tended to stress that there is nothing wrong with dying. This idea was rooted in a very different perception of ego. A person was simultaneously indispensable and dispensable in an appropriate way for the good of fellow beings. At a more primitive level, exactly the same principle may operate between wolves and their prey. The moose's death is something that is mutually agreeable. The moose may be constrained to die because he is old or injured, but there is still the ritual and the choice. There is nobility in such a death. The wolf grows strong eating an animal that knows how to die with its whole heart. He wastes away on the flesh of animals that do not know either how to live or how to die. In just the same way, Indians were reluctant to have anything to do with cattle. They would not eat them, they would not raise them or milk them, because there was no power in cattle. When Robinson Jeffers wrote, "What but the wolf's tooth whittled so fine, the fleet limbs of the antelope," he was telling, I think, only half the story. Predator and prey grow stronger together by means of a series of tests through all the years of their lives, tests that pit them against each other at both psychological and physiological levels, tests that weed both culturally and genetically. Wolf and moose seem to be far better at interspecies communication than we are. There is no reason why they should be confined to the antiquated, almost Newtonian system of behavior that we have devised for them. We should not be afraid, but we are, and profoundly so, to extend to the wolf and the moose the physical and metaphysical variables we allow ourselves. It is not man, but the universe that is subtle. And that was Barry Lopez, out of his volume of Wolves of Men in this.
That's a very fascinating passage there, an essay, I guess, a long essay.
Yes.
About predator-prey relationships. Of course, he put it in very emotional terms, but I noticed he was very careful. He carefully chose his words so as not to be unscientific, but, you know, speaking almost metaphorically.
Right.
About, you know, there's a communication. Well, yes, there is a communication of sorts that goes on. If an animal runs and is frightened, you know, that's pretty obvious. We can pick up on that. And so come other animals, you know.
He used a lot of quotations in there, too, like mm-hmm. around the yes and the no. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, I know that he understood that mm-hmm. it was not a, you know, a in the sense of a reality,
mm-hmm.
yes or no.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
That's very interesting. So do you have anything more? I mean, we've got about, 5 minutes here, and something short. That was a great, that's a wonderful piece.
It was, yeah. In this volume, Among the Wolves, that was edited by John Murray, in his introduction, he has, I guess it's a preface. He says that people are always asking him how they can help save controversial species such as the wolf, beyond reading books and renting Dances with Wolves.
That's good.
And he listed several things here mm-hmm. that I thought were very good, and I'll just kind of read those off too. He says, first, support through membership and donations those conservation organizations that are actively leading the fight for wolf preservation. And he lists off some of them. But he says, it never ceases to amaze me how much influence a determined band of people who pool their resources can have in this world. And I think that's exemplified by Friends of the Clearwater, actually. And then on secondly, he says, do everything you can to preserve habitat. And we here in Idaho, with our wonderful, incredibly huge wilderness wildlands, have the opportunity to do just that. And when people say we have enough, he says, when people say we have enough national parks, don't believe them, believe your eyes. Look at those filled-to-capacity campgrounds, those crowded trails, those mobbed bison and elk standing by the road. There are plenty of wild areas now in private ownership and plenty of funds available to buy them. Well, I don't know about that. He mentions the Federal Land and Water Conservation Fund.
Actually, there's a lot of money in that, but Congress has not allocated it.
No. Yeah, and this one won't.
It won't.
Yeah. Third, he says, speak out. Don't talk only with your friends and preach to the converted. Try to convince people who don't agree with you that a wolf or a mountain or a desert is worth saving. Fourth, he says, vote. Before voting, of course, and that's coming up real soon here, Check the history of your candidate for legislative or executive office. Most of the conservation groups will be happy to share these public records with you. Your elected officials will ultimately make those decisions that affect your life, whether your children hear a wolf pack howl one cold September night in Yellowstone's Hayden Valley, or whether you must tell them sadly that once there were wolves, but a small group of men killed them off, and then another, even smaller group made certain they never returned again. And fifth, he says, support science education in the public schools, which I think is possibly the most important one, but certainly right up there. How many of us still remember that field trip to the Natural History Museum where we saw the wolf pack hunting caribou in the Northern Alaska diorama?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Or the wolf man, in quotes, hired by the school to bring wolves to the gymnasium and show us what these misunderstood animals were all about. Well, I never had that privilege.
No, I didn't either.
But I know there are people out there who do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sue, that's been wonderful. Those readings about wolves. We're just about done. Any last words you want to pass along to the audience?
Well, again, you know, the last time I was on here, I was just asking for tolerance for the wolves, and I think that would be my hope today as well. That, you know, they're here among us, whether we agree with how they got there or not, they're here now, and we need to give them what they need. We need to give them space, and we need to give them tolerance, and we need to help save their habitat.
Well, thank you so much. You're listening to KRFP Moscow, Idaho. We're winding down the Wild Clearwater Country Show for today, October 3rd. Is it the 3rd today?
I think it's the 4th.
Actually, the 4th today. Excuse me.